Well, welcome back, everybody. Before we start, just a few practical announcements that Anusha has left me some notes about. Apparently, there's quite a few spots still left for the interviews, so maybe some of you may not know what an interview is. It sounds like I'm going to interview you and ask you how your meditation is going or something. I used to be a journalist, so I used to be the one interviewing. But actually, interview is just a word that, you know, it means that you can come and speak to me about... mainly about your meditation, but I guess other stuff also if you feel like it. If you have any questions about, you know, your meditation or you want to talk about your experiences or that kind of thing, that's an opportunity to do that. But it's totally optional, so if you prefer to go on the bushwalk, then that's totally okay too. But if you're interested, they're going to be held in that little area right across from the dining room. So there's like that carpeted area with two chairs, so... it's really the only place, so it should be obvious. That's where it's going to be held. And also, yes, encouragement to write questions for the Q&A if you prefer, rather than having a personal interview, to just write your questions on a piece of paper, and that way also other people can hear the answer. So that's also possible. Yeah, so that's it for practical stuff. So everybody looks like... they're settled and peaceful or somewhat. So I thought maybe this afternoon I would talk a little bit, not so much about technique, because it seems most of you already kind of know how to meditate, you said, but more about the qualities of mind or the attitudes that help support this whole this thing I keep on talking about, this open and receptive awareness. That comes about not just an act of will or some kind of ability that you develop as a skill, but it comes as part of a package of different qualities of mind that help support that attitude. So one really important quality, which I think is completely undersung in our modern society and way of life, is this value of contentment. You know, the ability to be content with what you've got. And I know in my own mind that it's like, it doesn't come naturally. And it's not because of any particular defect or deficiency in yourself, but if you look at how our society and our education system is kind of geared up for many of us nowadays, there's a lot of emphasis on kind of like getting the best or optimizing. Like, you know, like, Even if you go to the fast food, like, I guess as nuns we no longer can go, but I remember even like 10 years, 12 years ago when you went to McDonald's or Burger King or what's it called, your Hungry Jack's, it's like the big thing is like you can have it your way. So you can choose more lettuce or less tomato or like this sauce or that sauce, have it your way. And that's like, that's supposed to be a good thing, you know, that you can have things your way. Or even like... you know, taking a plane before, when I was growing up, it's like if you had to go on a long flight to be able to get a movie on the plane, you know, like if you just go 2-hour flight, you don't get it. So it's a big deal if you travel. Like when I went to go study in America, you would have these long haul flights from Asia to America. And it was like, oh, it's an opportunity to watch a movie on the plane. It was like so cool. And you would just have that big screen, you know, that everybody watched, because I flew economy, you know, you didn't have your personal screen. And then they would choose whatever, like one movie or two movies that they would play, and you had no choice, but you were so glad that you could watch a movie on this long-haul flight. Like, that was such a cool thing already, that you were, you know, willing to watch some movie that you normally wouldn't want to watch, and already you would sort of be happy to be able to watch a movie on the plane, because it's such a long flight, you know, what are you going to do? And so you're able to enjoy the movie. But like nowadays, it seems like I don't travel that often, but now even in economy, you have your own screen, and like there's so many channels and so many choices, which of course I can't watch anymore. I can watch the documentaries, but as I'm looking through like all the potential choices that people can watch, it's like mind-boggling. It's like everything is possible, and you could have it exactly your way. Like there's something for you that you might want at this particular time. And so when we're always given this ability, you know, to choose what particularly we want. It's like we lose the ability to be happy with something else that we didn't have the concept that we wanted it. So when we have this idea that, oh, I like this and I want it that way, and we're able to cater to that, then we lose our tolerance for when things don't go our way and we can't choose. And it's very difficult to be content with something that doesn't match our preconceived notion of what I want or what I like. Because we don't have as much opportunity to have experiences that aren't our way, you know, in many facets of life. Of course, that's in many facets of life, as usual, we can't choose, you know. But so much more we can choose, and we do choose. And because we have that habit now of picking what we want according to what we have an idea is our preference, then it's harder to develop this quality of contentment. It's so much easier to be discontent or dissatisfied with things that don't match, you know, our particular, you know, criteria of what is good. Like, you know, you don't have to say, but be honest. Like, maybe when you got to your cottage, I don't know how they assign the rooms, if it's first come, first serve, or they just put your names to whatever room. But, like, come on, the ones who, you know, you got the little room that's, like, near the front, you can't open your window, people walk by, and then there's, like, the rooms in the back that are bigger. Did you have a twinge of, like, oh, man, I got the small room, you know? Or, like, oh, man, I got the room that's, like, on the upper deck or the lower deck, and I don't want to walk up, or I don't want to, you know, like, there's preferences that we might not, you know, get exactly the best for us that we think is the best for us. But there's always the possibility to just think, but hey, I'm here, you know, in whatever cottage I'm in. At least I got a spot on this retreat, and I had the time to come. And that itself is like overpowers or overshadows the part that isn't quite right. But it doesn't come naturally, you know. Our minds are sort of geared to like think about what could be better, you know, or what, you know, what I don't particularly like or something. It seems it's strange, but it seems to be part of, I don't know if it's just modern, but something about our human instinct seems to zone in on what's wrong. And again, this might, like what I said earlier today, might be some sort of survival instinct of trying to solve problems in your life so that you can survive. But it's also something I think that's fed by, I mean, I didn't go to school in Australia, but I did go to international school, which sort of westernized, and I went to do my university studies in America, which is also Western style education. And I remember even in primary school, you know, we had these report cards, and one of the things that the teacher evaluated you on was critical thinking skills. I mean, primary school already, you're supposed to like learn how to be critical. And critical has two aspects of that word. I mean, there's the element of being, you know, able to like not just believe everything you hear and sort of be able to like reflect on it and have an opinion about things. And okay, that part is helpful and can help you to develop, you know, some wisdom and some ability to question. But the other part of critical that is part and parcel of that is finding the flaws in things. So in this case, it's finding a flaw in an argument or a flaw in a particular line of thought, which the good side is that it develops your inquiry. But the bad side is it develops that tendency to look for the flaws in things, not just in arguments or, you know, rationales, but just flaws in everything, you know, to be critical as in complaining, you know, to develop sort of a complaining mind or a fault-finding mind in other aspects of life, because it kind of comes together. And so I wonder if in schools or in education systems, there should instead be another box for developing uncritical thinking skills, you know, the ability to like find the good in whatever it is you're presented with, rather than or not only finding the flaws. I mean, everything has pros and cons. So probably the best, wisest thing is to be able to see both the pros and the cons. But the thing you choose to dwell on is the part that is going to determine your happiness. If you can see both the pros and the cons, but you dwell on the cons, then that's not really productive of peace of mind or happiness in your life. Whereas if you can see clearly the both things, but dwell on the pros, dwell on what's there that's good, and dwell on what's working and not what isn't, then it's a much more beautiful way to live, because then you see the beauty in your life. You see the beauty in the people around you, see the beauty in the situation you find yourself in. And most importantly, you see the beauty in yourself. Because the thing is, when we develop this critical mind towards things on the outside, it infects the way we also view ourselves, and we tend to be critical and see the faults in ourselves and dwell on those. And that's really just total recipe for a really unhappy kind of outlook on life. And these things, you know, they become so habitual that they happen so quickly in our minds that sometimes we can't help it. But the thing about developing awareness and, you know, practicing meditation is it helps us to see that when it happens in our minds. It helps us to catch ourselves when we see ourselves going straight for, oh, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with whatever it is? You know, this seat, oh, cushion too hard, cushion too soft, or the light's too bright, or, you know, like when we immediately go to that and see if we can catch ourselves and redirect our mind to notice, but what is good in this situation? So the lights are very bright, but you know what? It warms us. It makes the room a bit warmer when it gets a bit chilly in here. Or yes, the cushion is hard, but that's probably good for your spine, they say, to sit on something firm. So to be able to quickly do that is a skill that one can develop. And that's something that is going to really help with, you know, when you try to actually meditate on the breath or something like that, because you can see the beauty in it. And that's what allows the mind to rest and be open to an object. We can be open with things when we can feel satisfied with them. Do you notice that? That like when your mind slips off into thinking, A, it's partly because that's just a habit. But the other part is there's something about what you're experiencing that you find, you know, you're not satisfied with it. You find it unsatisfactory. You're somewhat discontent with it. That's why you have to look for something else. You have to look for some kind of comfort in thinking or entertainment in thinking, because you find, maybe you find the breath boring, or you find, you know, walking back and forth boring, or something. Or even, you know, even though the food was so nice, it's strange. I notice this in myself. I notice it's when I'm eating is the time when I'm often most distracted. It's like, or that when people go to these gourmet restaurants, you know, they have to talk to each other over dinner. So this poor, like, you know, whatever, Michelin star chef who's like devoted all this time to creating this beautiful meal for people to eat. And while they're eating, they're actually not really paying attention to the food. They're like talking to each other. Because somehow there isn't enough contentment to be found even in a, you know, very gourmet Michelin star meal. There's something about our minds that still is not completely satisfied with it, somewhat discontent with it, a little bit bored or something. And so it goes off into some kind of thought or some conversation. So the ability to develop a sense of contentment with what you're experiencing is what allows the mind to stay with it without struggle, without like forcing yourself to come back to the object of meditation or whatever it is you're thinking you want to focus on. So that's something that permeates, you know, not just our meditation but our life, the ability to stay with our experience without struggle. So that's something that, you know, I find is a quality that we have to kind of work on a little bit, you know? It doesn't just come naturally where you suddenly like, oh, yes, I think it's better. I know it's better to dwell on the positive in things or the good in things, and ergo it happens. No, it doesn't happen like that, because our habit of being critical, of being like, you know, fault-finding is quite ingrained. And so that's something that we have to, like, actually train the mind to say, you know what, I could complain about this. I could say it could be better, but let me think about how it could be worse. You know, that's a really fun exercise. No matter what it is you've got, think of how it could be worse, man. And it's like totally possible to think of how it could be worse. And then that almost in some weird way cheers you up. It's like to use negativity to cheer you up. But it's like this weird judo move where you like use negativity to fight negativity or something. But yeah, it's something that you can do. I remember when I was a kid in our school, we had this thing called like creative thinking like contest or something. And you had to pass around a particular object, right? And you had to think of like all these ways you could use it aside from what was obvious, like this is a cup, but what else could you use it for? You could use it as a shovel, you could use it as a spittoon, you could use it as a, you know, something to conk your little brother on his head with or something, you know? And it was like a skill we could develop. And I can see nowadays it still influences me. Because like at the monastery, you know, sometimes we have to decide, oh, should we get rid of this thing, you know, like. And the whole idea of monastic, you know, frugality or whatever is not to like just throw things away. So I'm always like, oh, but I see so much potential in this like plastic container. I mean, it could possibly be this or be possibly that. And so I'm like collecting all these random plastic containers that, you know, I haven't actually used, but I can see the potential. So I can see how this creative like thinking contest, it developed the skill in me that has stayed with me, which, you know, for better or for worse, but, you know, it stayed with me. So I wonder if like kids could have this contest in school where they could pass something around and like be like, what do you see that you like about this? You know, what do you see that's good about this object? And to think of as many things you could think of that is good or nice or useful about something. And to make that be something that just comes like immediately. Then it would be like a whole lot easier to develop this whole idea of contentment. And so it's never too late. This is something that we can always do, even now, whatever age we are. So if you find, you know, whatever is your most pressing issue in life right now, maybe when you have some quiet time to try to reflect, but what's good about it? You know, you might have this terrible backache, but hey, your shoulders feel fine and your feet feel fine and you can walk. And there's all these other parts of you that still work, you know, to have that kind of attitude and to actually actively cultivate it, not just in meditation, but in other times in your day, other aspects of your life. And I think that this sort of quality of contentment comes very closely related to a quality of gratitude or appreciativeness. And I find it's interesting, you know, many of you might know this, the Mangala Sutta. It's often chanted in Buddhist ceremonies or it's just part of daily Buddhist chanting. But it's a chant about, you know, the things that bring blessing into your life. And one of the interesting pairs is gratitude and contentment. And actually, contentment is said for contentment, santuti cha katanyuta. So it's contentment and gratitude. And I used to just chant this, you know, the way you chant things. And only recently I was reflecting on how these two are actually related. Because when you notice, you know, sometimes you might be in a situation that is, for instance, like in your school or your workplace or something that is shared by many people. You might have a particular set of circumstances that everybody experiences, but you can see how different people take it in such different ways. You know, the same workplace, the same school, the same monastery, you know, some people might be having a really hard time and find it like all these things wrong with it. This is bad and that is bad and this person is mean and that person is whatever, you know, like so many things wrong with it. And it's the exact same place that another person might be like, this place is great, you know, I love it. Like, and you're like, how can this be possible? It's exactly the same place. But that totally is how, you know, we make our own worlds. It's what we see in it. And so being able to be content with things allows us to be able to appreciate them the way they are and to feel a sense of gratitude for what it is we are receiving from a particular situation in our life. And when we have that sense of gratitude, it kind of really dulls that that sense of not good enough, you know, that sense of, oh, I don't like it here, or I don't like what this feels like, or whatever it is that your mind is finding some kind of issue with. When we have that sense of, oh, but I do appreciate X, Y, Z about it, it kind of allows us to be more content. It goes both ways. Like, being content with it allows us to be grateful for something. And developing a sense of gratitude and seeing the goodness in things allows us to be content with it. So the two of them really support each other. And it gives you a feeling of having a blessed life. You know, it doesn't bring blessing because of necessarily, like, it gives you particular material objects or a particular set of circumstances that you like. But the sense of blessing comes from seeing the blessing in your life, seeing the blessing in your situation, and then being grateful for the blessings you do have. And that really naturally gives your life a sense of being blessed. So it's not coming from the outside, it's coming from your own mind and how you see your situation. So, for instance, you know, like I said the other day, a little bit yesterday, about how just the fact that you were able to come here means that probably for many of you, there were people who helped you to have this time available, whether it's your boss at work who let you go off early on the Friday, or your spouse who's helping look after the kids or the other duties that have to be taken care of in the household, or, you know, even the retreat organizer who had to get all the stuff together and do the registration and, you know, set out all the cushions and all of the things that made this possible, to notice that. And then that naturally brings a sense of gratitude when we notice all the little things that have to come together for us to receive anything in our life. That makes it easier for us to naturally feel a sense of gratitude. So that can also be sort of actively cultivated. And when we have that appreciation for all those little things, you know, it's actually a form of wisdom. Because one thing that really struck me, that one of the things that the Buddha said, out of like five things that are, you know, like the precious gems that are hard to find in the world. So you have things like, oh, you know, people who can know the Dhamma and Vinaya and teach the Dhamma Vinaya, you know, properly and practice it to the end of the goal and all this sort of highfalutin stuff. And then the last one is like, and grateful people. like grateful people are really hard to find in the world. And you're like, really? Like, you're like, well, you know, you don't think you're like a complete ingrate. You think like, you know, like, is it really that hard? But actually it is, you know. Have you ever had the experience where you did something nice for someone, you know, and you sort of, it actually took a bit of trouble and time, you know, you actually put a bit of effort into it, and you get the sense that they don't really actually appreciate it, or they don't actually understand how much trouble it took you to do that thing. And you know, at first you can feel a bit sort of like, gosh, what an ingrate, or like, you know, like, I know you're supposed to do things without wishing for anything in return, but I mean, secretly, all of us want a little bit of a thank you or something, right? but the thing is, I was reflecting on that more, and I kind of, even in myself, you know, when I notice myself being sort of like lacking in gratitude or appreciation for people who are doing so many good things because they somehow have bothered us or annoyed us in some way, you know, I think that what it is, though, is that it's not from a meanness that people aren't grateful. It's from sort of a lack of understanding or seeing what was involved in giving them whatever it is, opportunity that they got, or whatever good thing that you helped, you know, bring about for them. It's like, not actually, they don't just actually see or understand all the steps it took, and that's why they can't appreciate it. So it's actually a matter of wisdom. It's like not being able to see the good and therefore not being able to appreciate it. So the thing that we can do to help cultivate that is looking deeper into any situation, like any small good thing you've gotten, Like, even the most minor things, for instance, if you just ask someone, oh, can you please print this out for me? You know, you think this one-page document, you know, can I don't have a printer, can I just email it to you, and can you please print it out for me? And you think that's, like, such a, like, you know, like a small thing, like, you know, no big deal. But you know how it is, right? It's like the one time someone asks you to print a page, that's the time that the printer has an error and, like, the cartridge runs out and, like, you have to, like, you know, have to go figure out, oh, how do I get a new cartridge and how do I, like, hook it up and, oh, and then there's an error and it doesn't come out properly. You have to do, like, many test pages, whatever. It's like this whole deal just to print this one page that someone asks you to print. And for them, and when you print it up, and they're like, oh, yeah, thanks, you know, like, they had no idea. You spent your whole afternoon trying to get this page to, like, print properly for them. And it's not because they're like, you know, these, like, you know, BSTRDs, you know, who have no sense of gratitude. It's because they just didn't know or understand how much trouble it took you. And that's how it is with other things in our life, bigger things in our life. I had a cousin, for instance, when he had his first child, he, like, told his mother, oh my gosh, I appreciate you so much more now. Because I now know how much it takes to take care of this small baby. Like, I had no idea it was that hard, you know? And so that's what it takes. Until you're actually in that situation, you have no idea how difficult it is. And you have no idea, you know, how much had to go into the good you received. So that's why when we... Sometimes we'll never be in that situation. For instance, I'm never going to be a parent, so I'm never going to know how hard it was for my mom and my dad. But at least now that I've seen that happen to my cousin, I can kind of, like, leave space for that, like, extra. Like, anytime someone does any good for you, just sort of give extra percent, you know, how much gratitude you have for that, because it probably took a lot more than you think. And that's something that when we have that sense of gratitude, even when we're going through very difficult times, you know, we can see. There's this beautiful phrase I like from this African-American poet, Maya Angelou. She says, she calls it the rainbows in the clouds. Like, even when we're going through really stormy weather, it's, like, really tough going. You know, I was speaking to someone earlier today, just had some losses in their family, and I've had that happen as well, and it's just... That time is just a really tough going time. And to have some friends who are, like, who care for you, who support you, who are looking out for how you're feeling, that is such a rainbow in the clouds. So that doesn't mean the clouds aren't there. It doesn't mean that it's not truly tough going right now, and that's just normal for the situation. But to have that, at least to have some rainbows in there, that gives you something, some beauty to look at and to appreciate. So that's something that actually we can always find the rainbows in the clouds. We can always, you know, sometimes you have to look a bit hard, but they're always there. So it's just a matter of having that sort of faith, you know, that it comes as part of the package. The clouds always comes with rainbows, and to be able to see them and look for them. And focus on that. Because when you do, that really lightens the heaviness of those hard times. And it really lightens the heaviness of your whole approach to life, you know, when we can see the rainbows. And that's something that brings a lot of lightness to the mind. Because when you have a lot of difficulty or heaviness, and you just get bogged down by it, it has a life of its own. It kind of multiplies. But if you say, yes, I feel really like crap right now, but look for the part that's light. Look for there's some rainbow in there, and try to notice that and send your mind towards that. There'll be some relief. And that's something that makes even meditation less onerous when you're like, you know, like when I said, oh my God, my first three-day weekend retreat type thing, I was like mostly thinking. And then I look back and I'm like, but hang on, that's not entirely true. Like, I remember that there were, amidst, like, all the thinking, there were like little, like, you know, spurts there where I was like able to like rest on the, follow the breath, you know, maybe, I don't know how long, maybe for 2 minutes or 3 minutes or 5 minutes or something here and there. But there were those moments in there. And I remember, you know, yeah, I remember there was like a metta meditation where you didn't have to focus on the breath. And like, and then that felt really good. I could follow that one. So there's actually, even though my memory of it, if you encapsulate it quickly, you might say, oh yeah, there's a lot of thinking in that. But actually, no, there was more than that. And so even on this first day or this part of the retreat, you know, if you feel like, oh gosh, you know, I still have lots of thoughts and thinking a lot and that kind of thing. But if you've had some moments, you know, 2 minutes here, 5 minutes there, of quiet and peace, focus on that and like appreciate that and rejoice in that part, because that's equally valid, it's equally there. And you know, I remember the advice I got one time when I was going through a sort of really hard time, and I was like, yeah, I was able to be with the breath, or able to be with the emotion, that whole stuff I was talking about earlier, you know, it's like it's really harder to do in practice. You know, yeah, I was able to be with the anxiety for you know, a second, and it really did release. But I'm like, but that was just one moment, you know, and I was like totally like discarding the value of that. But then this person said, yeah, that was one moment less of suffering for you. And that was like a really turnaround for me. I'm like, oh, yeah. Yeah, that totally, it's like gave it more value. It counts. When we're just like, oh yeah, but like the whole rest of the day really sucked. You know, then you it's almost like that gets lost and the value of that is completely, you know, obliterated. But if you say, yeah, that's one less second of suffering. In 24 hours, you had like 1 second less. That's still good, right? That's still a profit. So that's something that, yeah, changed it for me, you know, and can't say I can always, you know, keep sight of that, but when I can, yeah, it really does. It changes your experience a lot. So that's something that can be very helpful, you know. And developing these things takes time. And that's the other quality that maybe I wanted to touch on, was this quality of patience, you know. It's also completely undersung in our world these days where everything's about fast, you know, like, I just can't keep up with the pace of like even emails, you know, like I'm serving Venerable Metaji was here earlier. He was previously the secretary of the Australian Sangha Association. So he's been coaching me as I've been learning my job. I've taken this on for this term. And I'm just like, I'm not used to like having to email people back immediately, because like for years now I've had this like completely off-putting like instant message, you know, when people email my thing, it's like, oh, dear venerables and friends, you know, I rarely check my email, or I check my email very irregularly, so I'm sorry if I don't respond, you know, you know, quickly. And so I'm used to like being able to like put off doing my emails for like weeks or whatever. And so to have this sense of like, you didn't email the person back, you know, within a day, and already they write you back and you're like, did you get my email? And it's like, yeah, I got your email. Am I supposed to email you right back? Like, it takes me normally a week or 2 weeks to email people back. And so yeah, no, apparently even within the day is slow. Like with all this like instant messaging or whatever, it's like supposed to be within like a few seconds you get a response. Otherwise you think they're dead or something. And so I'm like, whoa, I'm not used to this pace. And you can see how that sort of pace makes it harder to develop patience. Because the expectation is for this immediate response all the time. And if you don't get a response, you get a bit antsy. And that's something that it carries over into other aspects of our life. So let us not undersing these things. Let us sing them up, so to speak. Not literally sing. But yeah, but patience is such a golden quality. Like the Buddha famously said, it's the greatest incinerator of mental defilements. That makes it sound like kind of like really gung-ho, but patience is a soft quality of being able to just wait, you know, like it takes time. And I think part of the reason why we can't wait for things to develop in their own time is because we don't have faith in the process. That's the other quality that's related. So I wanted to talk about patience and trust. That's another pair. And this word trust, you know, it's, I guess, confidence is another possible translation or word for it, but I actually struggle with this one. I remember when I was, first thinking of becoming a nun, I went to speak to this nun who was visiting Thailand from the English monastery in Amravati. I still remember Ajahn Sundara. And, you know, we were only talking a little bit. I mean, she had no idea who I was. She'd never met me before. We were talking not that long. And already she sussed out, you know, she just out of the blue, she sort of said to me, "You know what? You need to develop some trust." And I was like, bamboozled, like, trust in what? Like, what do you mean? What do you mean trust? And this, because we weren't, I wasn't talking about a situation of like someone had betrayed me or something like that. It wasn't like obviously about a trust issue. It was more like I was, thinking about becoming a nun and, am I ready? And how do I know if I'm ready? All this stuff, that sort of a kind of issue. And so I was kind of bamboozled by her answer, like, you have to develop trust. And I was like, okay, but, you know, it kind of rang true to me, but not clearly, you know, like, trust in what exactly? Because I guess, you know, like, if it's in Christianity, you would say trust in God. But if in Buddhism, it's like, well, what am I supposed to trust in? And this sort of became like a koan for me over the years, like, you know, this returning question of like, other people said it to me over the years too, other people in other situations. I'd be like, you have to develop trust. And I'd be like, again, I wish these people who advise me would also, you know, fill in the blank. Trust in what? Trust in what? What am I supposed to trust in, you know? And I'm still working on it, you know? I'm getting some answers come up in my mind about what exactly I'm supposed to trust in. And one of it is, like, trusting your mind, you know? Like, again, what the heck does that mean? But trusting the mind's innate ability, first of all, just to become still, you know? Like, we like having lots of meditation instructions because we are at a loss. We don't know how to make the mind still. And we want some recipe, you know, 1, 2, 3, do this, do that, and the thing will shut up finally. We want that, you know, but it's completely, like, against our whole programming to think that the mind knows how to do that on its own. And it does that on its own if you just let it. And I mean, even though I've heard this teaching over the years again and again, there's still a part of you that wants to tinker, you know? It wants to, like, make it happen. And actually, the weird thing is, there may be times when, you know, when you sit down to meditation and you're just too tired to, like, really do anything, you know? And then you naturally do this thing of, yeah, not doing anything, you know, finally being able to not do anything and not interfere. And the thing just, it does just randomly, magically quieten down by itself. Your mind naturally does that because that's its natural state. As long as you don't interfere. It's such a weird thing that you find it hard to believe, right? You find it hard to trust that that's going to happen. But yeah, sometimes when you really have no other choice, it does happen, you know? And I noticed that if I just, not even trust, but if I just say, like, if I start my meditation, sometimes I've done this, you know, like, I just say, like, I guess I'm influenced by American culture, but, you know, in California, they have these people called, like, the Valley Girls, and they talk like this. They're like, I don't even care, you know? And so sometimes I start my meditation, like, I don't even care. Like, I don't even care if I get peaceful. Like, I don't even care if, you know, I stop thinking. Like, I don't even care if I get some deep meditation. Like, I don't even care, you know? And this seems to be the magical solution, but don't do it deliberately. If you do it deliberately, it doesn't work again. But yeah, if you actually really can be like, I don't even care, you know? And you're just sitting there and like, I don't even care. It actually, I'm not trying to like follow any steps or remember the Anapanasati Sutta and, you know, like 1, 2, 3. I'm not remembering anything. I'm not trying to do anything. I'm not following any recipes. Like, I don't even care. It actually, the mind knows what to do on its own. It really does. And the thing is, it's not just that the mind knows how to be still, but the mind is naturally has some innate wisdom in it. There is some wisdom in all of us already there. We just have to be still and quiet enough to access it. So trusting in that, trusting that your mind knows how to meditate, but also trusting that your mind knows how to navigate you actually in the right direction, metaphorically. Maybe spatially, not always, but metaphorically, you know, it actually can. And it is helpful to seek the advice of wise people when you have some kind of issue or problem in your life. Their input is valuable. But actually, within yourself, you also have that wisdom. And it's just trusting yourself enough to listen to it and believe that is actually real wisdom. I mean, that's something I've found is actually one answer of what to trust in. So trusting in your own mind, trusting in the actual purity of your own mind in its natural state, trusting in the natural beauty of your mind, the brightness of your mind, the stillness of your mind. All of these wonderful qualities are already innate to your mind. It's about accessing by learning how not to do stuff that interferes with it, you know. And that's actually, you know, not easy to do, because that's what we do. We do stuff. Even we do not doing, you know, we want to do that one too. But this element of trust really, for me, helps to take your hands off the steering wheel of your life and sort of just kind of trust in one's own goodness, but also the goodness of other people, and just sort of the natural flow of life, that it does find resolution by itself. So that's something that can really help support our patience. Because when we trust in our minds, and we sort of trust in the natural process of the mind settling down, it's easier for us to wait. You know, it's harder for you to wait for something when you're not sure it's ever going to come, right? You know, you have those friends, right? Those friends who, like, you make appointments with, and maybe 7 or 8 times out of 10, they either don't show up, or they show up really late or something. I'm probably one of those people who show up late. But, you know, there are these people who are sort of like, they have a track record. You wanna say that, oh, don't like, you know, kind of like put anybody in a box. But, yeah, there's some people maybe that they have a track record. So you find it harder to be patient with them because you think maybe they're just not going to show up. But if you have something that you trust in, it's like maybe some friend who is very reliable. And let's say they're late to an appointment, but so many times in the past they've always come to their appointment. It's easier for us to be patient for that person, isn't it? Right? Because you have this sense of, you know, they're going to come. They just might be held up by something. So it's similar. So being patient with your mind as you meditate, like even though it's like, oh, it's been one morning, or it's already 3 o'clock now, maybe it's still whatever, you know, whatever level of peace you have. But you know, it takes a while. And if we can trust in the natural process, it's easier to just give it time, give yourself time, give your mind time. And you know, it's not something you can do in just a day. You know, even a week, heck, even like years or 10 years, you know. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm keeps like consoling me with this idea that, like, oh, Anuruddha, you know, it took him 17 years. And it's like, hey, that only leaves me 5 years left, man. Like, you know. But the thing is, no, like, whatever, you know, if 17 years, so it's 70 years, so it's 70 lifetimes. The thing is, who cares, you know? It's about if it's about the present moment, then time becomes less relevant because now is not in relation to anything else. There's only now, right? So if we can just be more present in the now, even patience becomes irrelevant because patience means we're sort of like, oh, okay, we're willing to wait for something that's going to happen eventually. We have to just be more gracious in our waiting period. But it's actually more profound than that. It's actually that if you're really here in the present moment, there's nothing to be patient for, you know, like you're not waiting for something, but you're patient with this moment, whatever it may be. So you're sitting here and maybe you're starting to get bored or something, or maybe you're listening. But the thing is, you're patient with this moment. Okay, somebody's yabbering and you're hearing it and you're just patient with that. Okay, sound is happening. Or you're starting to feel a bit sore as you sit for a long time and your back is starting to hurt. But okay, that's what it feels like. And you're just there with that experience right now and you're patient with it, meaning you're just open to it. Then it's not about waiting for something to happen. It's just being right here. And that's actually real patience. So all of these things, you know, they actually come together. It's like almost like just different angles on the same thing. It's different angles of being able to develop this very simple sounding, but actually very, very, you know, difficult to do thing of not doing and just being right here, right now with what you're experiencing. Just as it is. That's perpetually what this whole practice is about, you know? That's basically all it is. And so whether you do it in sitting form or walking form or talking to people form or not talking to people form, it's about this. It's about being able to be happy right now, right here, with what your experience is, content with it. You know, you don't have to be ecstatic all the time, but just being able to be content with it. Like, this is good enough. So that's actually a really good mantra, which I first heard it, you know, like a really long time ago when Ajahn Brahm was teaching a one-day retreat. And that was one of the things I took away from that was using the mantra good enough. Like, as you breathe in, you say good, and as you breathe out, you say enough. And it was almost like magic. it makes you really feel it. Yeah, actually, this is good enough. Just a simple breath, you know, something that seems so repetitive and boring, you know, on one level, is actually just good enough. And just being able to sit here, doing nothing else, but just being with your breath, is actually really good enough. And it's not this kind of good enough where you're like some kind of like some ascetic thing where it's like, oh yes, I'm really tough. I can be content with my bed of nails, you know. You know, like not that kind of content. It's not like oh, you're so like, you know, simple and tough that you don't need much to be happy. But it's about genuinely being content because you think it's great. You think your bed of nails is great. You know, you really appreciate the bed of nails. Or you really appreciate, you know, I don't know, plain oatmeal. Gosh, I can remember, you know, the first time I stayed at Dhammasara, I was a layperson. You know, one of my duties was to cook breakfast every day. And one of the things was to cook oat porridge every day. And I remember thinking, oh, these poor nuns, they have to eat this tasteless slop every day. Like, oh, like I really felt sorry for them, you know? But now, you know, now at the monastery, like, things have changed, and it's like the people in charge of breakfast are not required to cook oat porridge every day. It's only when they feel like it, they do it. And otherwise, you know, you open your Uncle Toby's and you pour hot water in it, and you make your own, like, you know, instant oatmeal, you know? And so the days when there is, like, cooked oat porridge, you're like, wow, there's like cooked oat porridge today. Like today, Nicholas and Hariti brought me like, you know, hot oat porridge, but like foil on top so it remained warm actually. It was like, wow, like cooked oat porridge, you know? And you really, it's not like a fake, like, oh, I'm such a simple nun, you know, I can eat just simple food. No, it's like you're genuinely, like, really grateful for, like, cooked oat porridge that's hot, you know? And so that's something that, yeah, it's a real joyful kind of contentment. And it's not any kind of, like, oh, like, sanctimonious, I'm so simple, you know? It's really genuinely appreciating the things in life, because you see the beauty in them, the real beauty in them. And so that's such a nice quality to develop, you know, whether you meditate or not, you know, that's really a good one. And it's something that, yeah, you can try that mantra, good enough. Or even thank you, you know, it becomes almost this, like, very, very sort of, I don't know, like, just a everyday kind of phrase that you see on, you know, I don't know, you see on doors, like, thank you for not smoking, or, you know, like, like people just say, you know, thank you all the time. But if you actually use that as a mantra, you know, breathe in, thank, breathe out, you, like the sense of thanking your life for being what it is, you know, thanking yourself for still being alive in this day and age, you know, to still even be here and not to be in WA when, you know, COVID isn't really such a problem. And it's just being able to see that itself is such a blessing, and to thank whatever forces that makes it possible for your life to be what it is now. So breathing in that thanking, breathing it out to you, whoever you is, this greater you. I mean, you can try that and see how that makes your mind feel. So we can really be creative in our meditation. I love mantras because you can keep changing them according to what it is your mind feels like it needs. You can kind of offset whatever kind of imbalance might be there with whatever cool phrase you want to use. I wouldn't change it every 2 seconds, but, you know, for a particular sit, you might choose something. And if it's, you know, the right thing for that time, it may not be the right thing for the sit you do later on in the day, and you can keep changing it. But I find that one, like, really, really helpful, this whole good enough business, or whatever words you want to use. So you can try that as you do your meditation and see how that works. So, you know, whatever I say, I hope it's good enough. but I was told, actually, it was pretty funny, I was told that, oh, you know, people would be just so happy just to see a nun. So I'm like, oh, great. So all I have to do is bring my estrogen and the right chromosomes. I forget which they are, X or Y, whatever, or both. Whatever it is that makes me female, I'll just bring those along and it should be grand. And then anything else is bonus. If I say something intelligible, that's just bonus. But here I am, a female person as a monastic. There you go. And so, you know, it's good enough. And so that's, you know, possibly good enough for this session. So, yeah, so I wish you, you know, a nice rest of the afternoon. So I'll be doing interviews at 4:20. That gives people time to, you know, go to the toilet, have a drink, whatever. And I will be out in that vestibule or that foyer, whatever it's called. And I'll see whoever wants to go then. And if you haven't signed up yet, you still can. And if you don't want to sign up, that's still fine. So yes, go off, enjoy the day. And I will as well. So see you later. For the night session, we'll be at 7:30, is it? Yeah, 7:30. And I suppose I should explain about this whole, I just say bow to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, but I guess I never explain what that means. So I guess the Buddha is just bowing to this quality of awakeness, you know, that's what the Buddha is. He's one who is awake. And then the Dhamma is the truth. So the truth is universal. So whether you're Buddhist or not, it's just bowing to truth. And then the last one is the Sangha is just people who practice well, people who are pure in heart, you know, people who are really kind and generous and compassionate. So bowing to that, whether you're Buddhist or not. So it's just something that I wanted to say, that it doesn't actually have to be a Buddhist thing. It could be bowing to just bigger qualities of the heart and the mind. So anyway, it doesn't mean you have to bow. That just means that's an explanation of why I do it. So off we go.